From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Less than 2 weeks before Election Day, Americans are voting in droves. President Trump is rallying supporters today in Gastonia, North Carolina. Former Vice President Joe Biden is preparing for tomorrow's debate. NPR politics reporter Scott Detrow is here, so we're all in place. Hi, Scott.
Hey, good afternoon.
And start with the fact that former President Barack Obama and not former Vice President Biden will hit the campaign trail in Philadelphia today. Are Democrats worried that Biden is not out on the trail?
You know, not really. They feel like Biden's doing what he needs to do. He's certainly been out campaigning all across the country a lot more in the last month and a half than he was previously. But they feel like Biden is getting his message across, especially given the fact that the Biden campaign is just blowing the Trump campaign out of the water in terms of advertising dollars spent on messaging. Biden's focusing on the upcoming debate and getting prepared for it. We know that's an event that tens of millions of people will tune into. And with the election so close, it's really President Trump's last chance to change the trajectory of this race. So the Biden campaign feels like that's worth spending the time. And I think we can assume that he will get out on the campaign trail as soon as that debate's over.
Because we're also hearing that the campaign is, you know, warning campaign workers, don't get too comfortable. You know, you never can be too comfortable. And President Trump is out there, but he's insulting Anthony Fauci, CNN, COVID-19, you know, acting like it's just going away, attacking 60 Minutes correspondent Leslie Stahl after apparently becoming frustrated with her questions in an interview. His fans at rallies love this, but is his party worried about his approach?
You know, I think it's telling that you've started to see some Senate Republicans on the ballot this year. People like Ben Sasse in Nebraska, John Cornyn in Texas, feel the need to start saying, I disagree with the president at times. I've not always supported the president. That is a sign that they feel like the president could be more of a vulnerability than a positive in their elections. And the fact that these are people running in places like Nebraska and Texas tells you a lot. I think we forget that in 2016, one thing President Trump did really well was have a very focused message, especially in those final weeks of the race. He really hasn't had that at any point this campaign, and it has a lot of Republicans worried.
Yeah. Talk about Pennsylvania, because yesterday the president was in Erie. Today, former President Obama's in Philadelphia, where he's going to speak to black voters at a drive-in car rally. And yesterday he released this video on Twitter. It makes a plea to young voters. Let's listen.
I know Joe better than almost anybody. I trust him to be a great president. He's different. He's on the right side of the issues. He'll get the job done. And Joe and Kamala will want you to keep pushing them to get the job done.
So why is Obama appearing now? And, you know, if in fact the campaign isn't that worried that Biden's not out. And both he and Trump, as we said, are in Pennsylvania. What's going on in that swing state?
Sure. Well, Obama was always going to come out into the race at some point. He's still the biggest name in Democratic politics. He had a really blunt speech at the Democratic National Convention. This is, of course, his first time out on the campaign trail, or whatever the campaign trail is, with drive-in rallies on the Biden side of things. Pennsylvania is probably the most important state on the map. Remember, President Trump only won it by 44,000 votes in 2016. And you're seeing this geographic distribution. This is how campaigns are typically run. The Democrats try to run up the vote total in Philadelphia and the Philadelphia suburbs, Republicans in the western part of the state. I think what's notable is that Joe Biden has actually made a lot of campaign trips to more rural parts of the state, western parts of the state. He was in Erie a couple of weeks ago. Biden is trying to have a presence there, even though he'll still probably lose that part of the state. If he loses it by a smaller margin than Clinton, that puts him in really good shape statewide.
Just briefly on the final presidential debate tomorrow night, mics are going to be muted for parts, but not for others. And President Trump has been tweeting out that Biden is a criminal because of those unsubstantiated emails that claim the Biden family did crooked business in Ukraine. Again, unsubstantiated. And there's also new reporting that President Trump has a bank account in China, which his campaign says is dormant. Should voters approach this debate with trepidation? You know, there's going to be a lot of mud slung. And I guess conversely, if people really are trying to hear something that will help them make up their minds, these few undecided voters, you know, what will they be looking for?
I think the biggest factor is what the president does. We all saw how the polls reacted to his performance in that first debate, the way that he just relentlessly attacked and interrupted the whole time. Not many voters really came away from that with a positive view. The question is, does the president repeat that? His campaign seems to be indicating he'll take a different approach. But, I mean, you mentioned that 60 Minutes interview. Every single interview or town hall or debate that the president has had over the last couple months, it's been pretty much the same story from his end of things. And again, voters have not seemed to be really warm towards that, aside from his core base.
Saying everybody's terrible. We'll see what happens. NPR politics reporter Scott Detrow, thank you.
Thank you.
And breaking news from the Department of Justice today. Purdue Pharma, the makers of OxyContin, will plead guilty to 3 federal charges as part of an $8 billion settlement for its role in the opioid epidemic. Since 2000, opioid overdoses have killed more than 250,000 Americans. And today, Purdue admitted to defrauding the Drug Enforcement Agency as well as paying doctors in an illegal kickback scheme to write more prescriptions of OxyContin. Let's bring in Brian Mann, who covers addiction for NPR. And Brian, first of all, give us some more details about what Purdue Pharma is pleading guilty to in this settlement.
Yeah, what Purdue Pharma says they did here or acknowledges that they did is, first of all, they worked with a computer software maker to manipulate the prescribing advice that doctors received as they were treating patients. Doctors thought they were getting neutral, objective guidance. Instead, according to the Justice Department, Purdue's marketing department was literally right there in the room with the doctor and the patient guiding the use of opioid medications, over-prescribing, according to these allegations. The other thing that the Justice Department says here is essentially Purdue Pharma claimed that they were monitoring and controlling the oversale of drugs, but in fact, a lot of their medications were being diverted, and Purdue Pharma now acknowledges that they didn't do enough to keep these drugs from getting into the wrong hands.
And Purdue will have to pay an $8 billion fine. As we mentioned, what will happen to the company as a result of this settlement?
Yeah, this part is a little bit in the weeds, but it works like this. Essentially, if this deal is approved by a federal bankruptcy judge, Purdue Pharma will be reinvented as a public trust company. The Sackler family that owns it now will lose control of the firm. And here's something that's really interesting, Peter. This company doesn't have enough money right now to pay out $8 billion in settlement. So essentially what would happen going forward is that Purdue Pharma in this new form would continue to sell opioid medications, and the profits from those purchases and sales would go to help pay off all these communities around the country suffering from the addiction crisis. So there's this very complicated idea built in here that going forward, the sale of opioid drugs would be used to pay for treatment and rehabilitation for the millions of Americans who have been caught up in this addiction crisis.
You mentioned the Sackler family, the company behind Purdue Pharma, the people behind the Purdue Pharma, rather. They became one of the richest families in America off the sale of OxyContin. And at one point, they were transferring their money out of Purdue and into offshore bank accounts. Now, many states and families, frankly, want to hold them personally liable, but will they?
Yeah, this is one of the elements of this, Peter, that's infuriating a lot of people. What the Justice Department says is that the Sacklers will give up control of their company. They'll pay $225 million of their personal wealth as part of the settlement. But what a lot of critics, including attorneys general all over the country, are saying is that they are still going to walk away with billions of dollars, as much as $10 billion in profits from these opioid sales. They'll still be very, very wealthy. There are no criminal prosecutions in this deal of any of these individuals. The Justice Department says they might still do that at some point in the future, but the people I'm talking to are skeptical about that. They're saying with this package as it's structured here, the Sacklers are going to walk away very, very wealthy, not serve any prison time, and many people are saying they're essentially getting off scot-free.
You know, Brian, it's worth noting that this legal challenge has been going on for a long, long time. You've been following this story, and now all of a sudden the settlement is coming out, and we're just, less than 2 weeks from the presidential election. Do you think that President Trump, who has talked a lot about the opioid epidemic early on in his administration, will he use this as an opportunity to tout something that he's done here just before the election?
It's going to be very interesting to see how he plays this. You know, he did do more with the addiction opioid crisis than he's done with coronavirus. His response to opioids was much more structured. And it is possible that he'll point to this and say, look, you know, I've passed bills, I've increased funding, and here's another settlement. This hasn't been an issue on the campaign trail in 2020 the way it was in 2016. But yes, this could be something that President Trump might point to as a win. He'll get a lot of pushback on that, again, from state attorneys general, including some Republican attorneys general around the country who say this just isn't a good enough deal.
Yeah, Brian Mann covers addiction for NPR, talking about the latest settlement with the Department of Justice and Purdue Pharma, $8 billion and criminal charges. Brian, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We've been looking at the presidential candidates' positions on education, healthcare. Today, foreign policy. The Republican incumbent, Donald Trump, says the backbone of his is power.
America is fulfilling our destiny as peacemaker, but it is peace through strength. We are stronger now than ever before. Our weapons are at an advanced level like we've never had before, like, frankly, we've never even thought of having before. And I am proudly putting America first.
His Democratic challenger, former Vice President Joe Biden, invokes power as well.
We've been most effective as a world leader, in my humble opinion, not just by the exercise of our power, the most powerful nation in the world, but the power of our example. That's what's led the rest of the world to follow us on almost everything.
Biden went on to say that the president's example is turning allies against the U.S. But President Trump has pulled out of the Iran nuclear deal, the Paris Climate Accord, made historic deals in the Middle East. What would a second term look like? How will Biden approach China, North Korea, Russia? Philip Gordon is senior fellow in U.S. foreign policy at the Council on Foreign Relations. And Philip, let's just say at the outset, President Trump doesn't list his policies. There's no health care plan or foreign policy outlined on his website. But we've had 4 years of seeing it. So how would you characterize it?
I guess I would use the president's own words, America first. He has distanced himself from a long tradition of U.S. foreign policy of engaging the rest of the world through alliances and partnerships and international institutions and respecting norms. He talked about power in the clip that you played, but it's power in a very narrow and distinct use of the word. It's, you know, spending $700 billion on the military, but not, unlike in the clip you've played from Vice President Biden, understanding power in a broader way, which includes partnerships, alliances, and respect and credibility in the world.
Well, he did pull out of the Iran agreement, as we said, the World Health Organization, angry about the way they view China and the coronavirus, the Paris Climate Accords, and he's threatened a NATO withdrawal. Any sense of what a second term would mean for NATO in the U.S.?
Well, I think all of the things that you mentioned tip Trump's hand about what he would do in the second term. The door would be open for a much more aggressive pursuit of this sort of nationalist America first policy, in the sense that even many of the things that you mentioned, he didn't get around to until well into his first term. If you remember, especially the first year, he was surrounded by what people at the time called the adults in the room, and they persuaded him not to go too aggressively down this path. And they were more traditionalists, Generals Kelly, McMaster, Secretary Tillerson. But I think over time, he's gotten rid of those more traditional advisors. He's going more with his gut. And if reelected after pursuing that policy, I think he would feel free to question even much more controversial things like U.S. membership in NATO. So far with NATO, all he has done is challenge it, criticize allies for not contributing enough to common defense, and question the core Article 5 treaty guarantee of defending allies by saying, well, that's only valid if you, as he puts it, pay your bills. In the second term, it could go all the way to the point of actually pulling out of the alliance. And, you know, that's something that National Security Advisor John Bolton specifically warned about for a second term.
One of Trump's biggest bragging points at rallies is that he authorized the assassination of a top Iranian general while that general was visiting in Iraq. Is Trump right that that made us safer?
I put that in the to-be-determined category. I don't think anybody in America is shedding tears over the death of Qasem Soleimani, who had a lot of American blood on his hands and, you know, wreaked havoc throughout the region and interfered in neighboring countries to Iran. But I say to be determined because it already provoked Iranian retaliation in the form of ballistic missile strikes against bases in Iraq that had Americans, dozens of which had to then go to the hospital with severe injuries and could have been killed. And there have been subsequent Iranian-backed attacks on U.S. forces in Iraq, leading to the point that the Trump administration is actually considering or has threatened to close our embassy in Baghdad because it can't be secured.
What about China? Early on, the president was effusive about its leader. People thought he was naive. Then he pivoted, imposed tariffs. More recently, blames China for the coronavirus against all scientific evidence. What does a future relationship with China under President Trump look like?
Yeah, I mean, that's a tricky one, as you say, Robin, because we've seen, both extremes. Trump talking about his very good friend, President Xi, and praising his action and transparency on the coronavirus, because, at the time he was trying to butter up the Chinese president to get what Trump really wants, which is a trade deal that would reduce the U.S. trade deficit. But when that proved impossible, all Trump has done is just ratchet up the sanctions. And I suppose that's what we would expect for a second term. In the past year or so, the Trump administration has really amped up the rhetoric on China. Again, after Trump failed to squeeze this trade deal out of President Xi, and now, there's just sort of relentless campaign by Trump and his top official, Secretary Pompeo, to denounce the Chinese Communist Party and really confront it. And it resonates because I think, there's a bipartisan agreement that China is a problem, what it's doing domestically and in Hong Kong and vis-a-vis the Muslim residents in Xinjiang, and its threatening behavior in the South China Sea. So I think there's a bipartisan consensus on being tough on China. But I also think it's fair to say that the way Trump has defined dealing with it, at least so far, has not worked. These unilateral tariffs, which are the core of the Trump approach to China, have so far not produced a better trade deal or better Chinese trade practices, nor even reduced the U.S. trade deficit with China. But they've resulted in retaliatory tariffs from China on the U.S. that, contrary to what President Trump asserts repeatedly, are paid by American taxpayers, consumers, and importers. And, we've actually had to tax the American taxpayer even more to bail out farmers who lost markets in China because of the Trump tariffs. When you're looking for differences between the candidate, Vice President Biden has also underscored a desire to be tough on China, but he is proposing to do it together with our allies to have more leverage on China rather than unilaterally attacking both China and those allies at the same time.
Well, let's go to Joe Biden. You just laid out his China thoughts. Can we just sum it up by saying that he might reverse just about everything that Donald Trump has done? Rejoin the WHO, rejoin the Iran nuclear deal, the Paris Accord, kind of rejoin the world.
The world. Yes, rejoining and repairing is what Vice President Biden has sort of articulated as a theme of his foreign policy. And on those specific things that you mentioned, he's already addressed them and said immediately he would rejoin the Paris Climate Pact. On Iran, he said if Iran returns to full compliance with the deal, the United States would rejoin it as well and then look to launch negotiations on the future. He would rejoin the World Health Organization, which somehow Trump has decided was a good idea to pull out of during a pandemic. He would reiterate our commitment to NATO Article 5, as we were discussing earlier, the defense guarantee. And so that's already a big agenda, restoring some of the international relationships and partnerships and commitments that the United States had previously made that President Trump withdrew from.
What about Israel? The president has supported Prime Minister Netanyahu's push for settlement in the West Bank. He moved the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem, something that outraged Palestinians and those hoping for a two-state solution, but won praise from evangelicals and parts of the Jewish community. Helped broker two peace agreements with two Gulf states. He thinks he should get the Nobel Peace Prize for this. But where would Joe Biden be different here?
Joe Biden would also be strongly supportive of Israel. He's made that clear for decades, and he said that his support for Israel would be unshakable. And he also supported the normalization agreements with the Gulf states. It was something that Democratic administrations had pursued for a long time. He said he wouldn't reverse the move of the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem, although I think he and others and most Democrats would have liked to see it be part of an agreement with the Palestinians rather than unilaterally like President Trump did. But one thing that is different on that set of issues is Vice President Biden has also said that he would reverse Trump's approach towards the Palestinians, which has really just consisted of punishment for not going along with the so-called deal of the century that he proposed between Israel and the Palestinians. But he proposed a deal that essentially just aligned the United States with Israeli preferences and priorities. And the Palestinians, not surprisingly, rejected it. And Trump responded to that by cutting U.S. assistance to the Palestinians, by cutting U.S. assistance to the U.N. refugee agencies that help Palestinians, by closing the Palestinian representation in Washington. And Vice President Biden said that he would restore all of those efforts and policies and start talking to the Palestinians again and try to work towards this two-state solution.
We only have a little time here. So I just have to ask you very briefly, Russia. The president has refused to say anything critical of Putin, even as we know Russia's interfering again in our elections. What can we expect of Joe Biden to do?
I think he would take a much harder line on Russia, both in terms of election interference, which is the most glaring thing that Trump has refused to address or even acknowledge. I mean, it's just an overt attack on our institutions. And I think Vice President Biden would take a much tougher line on that. But also, as I said, NATO, defense of our allies in NATO, something that Trump, just for some odd reason that no one has been able to explain in 4 years, has been willing to do. I know we're running out of time. We've discussed most of the big issues, but I think we also have to underscore climate if we're thinking about issues where there's a difference between the two candidates, because in addition to rejoining world institutions, Vice President Biden has said that he would make dealing with the climate a priority and spend the money necessary to halt and slow climate change and rejoin the Paris Climate Agreement, whereas on the Trump side, it's something that he doesn't even acknowledge as a serious foreign policy issue. That's probably the most dramatic difference between the two.
You can't do climate without people from other countries. Philip Gordon, Senior Fellow in U.S. Foreign Policy at the Council on Foreign Relations, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And we note he served as an informal advisor to the Biden campaign.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from MIT's System Design and Management, jointly offered by MIT's School of Engineering and the MIT Sloan School of Management. Earn a master's in engineering and management. STM educates mid-career professionals to solve complex challenges at the intersection of business and technology, with over 20 years of on-campus, hybrid, and distance education experience. Join a virtual info session on Wednesday, October 21st from 7 to 8 p.m. sdm.mit.edu.
Americans are losing their faith in a coronavirus vaccine. A recent survey by our partners at Stat News in the Harris Poll found 58% of Americans said they would get a COVID-19 vaccine once one is available, and that's down considerably from mid-August. For more, let's bring in Stat senior writer and PharmaLot columnist Ed Silverman, who's on a Skype line. And Ed, just a few months ago, 69% of people Stat polled said they would get a coronavirus vaccine. What's driving those numbers down?
I think the key issue here for a lot of Americans is confidence in whether a vaccine will be safe and effective. President Trump, in particular, has regularly touted the possibility of a vaccine becoming available, not so coincidentally, before the November 3rd election. But there's also, at the same time, growing concern expressed by any number of scientists, academics, public health experts, that perhaps a vaccine that is available that quickly may not be truly safe or effective, or at least we won't know enough information about any one vaccine that quickly.
And that's the exact reason why pharmaceutical companies and the FDA have tried to take steps to separate the approval process for a vaccine from politics to boost people's confidence in it. The poll numbers appear to show that hasn't really worked yet to make people feel more comfortable. But I want to ask you about something else the poll showed. Important differences by race. Black Americans were even less likely to take the vaccine than white Americans. Talk about that.
Unfortunately, there's been systemic distrust of the healthcare system in the United States by the African American community. And that is also exacerbated by the pandemic, because data has shown that blacks have suffered disproportionately in terms of access to healthcare and the actual number of hospitalizations and deaths. So there's this milieu almost that contributes very directly to how not only access to a vaccine, but the safety of a vaccine might affect their community. And it's a much, much bigger drop. The poll found that 59% of whites indicated they would get vaccinated as soon as a vaccine is ready. This is in early October. That's down from 70% in mid-August. But among blacks, only 43% said they would pursue a vaccine as soon as it was available. And that's down from 65% in mid-August.
So, Ed, I think the next question is the key one. If the vaccination rate drops that low, will it work?
Assuming a vaccine, one or more vaccines, is safe and effective, it will work for some, let's hope. But for those who don't get vaccinated, you know, in terms of health, they could obviously be at risk. And that just makes it more difficult for the country at large to control the pandemic. So we won't accomplish our larger public health goal. And it takes a very large messaging effort to try to convince people that they should investigate getting vaccinated if, in fact, we do have reliable, solid data to indicate a vaccine could do the job. Easier said than done.
Yeah. That's senior writer Ed Silverman with our partners at Stat News, the health and medicine publication. Ed, thanks for your time and thanks for your insight on this poll.
Thanks for having me. Stay safe.
In addition to voting for senators, governors, representatives, and of course, president, voters in 32 states are also deciding on ballot measures in this election. In Colorado, voters will decide whether gray wolves should be reintroduced to the wild. Voters in Arizona, Montana, New Jersey, and South Dakota will decide if recreational marijuana should be legalized. And Mississippi voters will make a decision on a new state flag design after a Confederate emblem was removed earlier this year. Let's take a look at some of these ballot initiatives with Josh Altick. He's a project director at Ballotpedia. Hey, Josh.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
And we're going to dig into some of these state ballot measures in just a minute. But first, big picture, what kind of trends are you seeing across the country when it comes to ballot initiatives?
I would say the biggest one is election policy. There's a huge amount of attention on various measures to change things like redistricting processes, term limits, kind of some old topics that keep coming back to the ballot, some suffrage issues included as well, campaign finance. So all of your kind of usual suspects when it comes to elections policy, but just a lot of them this year.
Well, to that point, I'm interested in this ballot measure in Alabama, Colorado, and Florida. People will be voting on whether to change existing constitutional language to say, quote, only a citizen of the United States who is 18 years old or older has the right to vote, rather than every citizen of the United States. What's that about?
Right. Yeah, that one's interesting and is getting a lot of both positive and negative attention. When in fact, it appears that there's not a huge practical effect to these measures passing. Most states already require citizenship to vote. Now, in some cases, there are local elections where that citizenship requirement is not in effect. Usually it's for like a school board election or something like that, but those are few and far between. And so for the most part, these won't have an effect. The effect that proponents are going for is a more preemptive one. They're saying, we see this trend towards possibly letting people who are not proven citizens vote, especially in local elections, and we want to head that off. Opponents think this is a kind of a scheme to get attention on an issue that's not an issue. Some people think it's maybe an effort to get turnout among a certain demographic. So a lot of varying opinions, and it's unclear exactly what they will do.
All right, let's talk about the legalization of drugs here for just a minute. Recreational marijuana is often on the ballot in states across the country. This year, we see it in Montana, South Dakota, New Jersey, and in Arizona. By the way, it was on the ballot in Arizona back in 2016, but it failed.
That's right.
Is that usual for a ballot measure that failed to be revived like that?
It really depends on the climate. The initiative process is especially susceptible to trends. So if you have a trend like marijuana that's had huge success at the ballot and, you know, been successful in 9 states and even probably moved some states like Illinois and Vermont to legalize directly, then yeah, why not try again? Public opinion on marijuana has changed so drastically in the 10 years. it makes sense. But sometimes you see efforts try and then just never try again because of what the defeat was like. It's like 50% of the time they'll try again, though. You'll see the California ballot has a lot of repeats. But Arizona was pretty unique in 2016. It was the first measure where opposition spent as much or more than support. So I think that was one factor in trying it again as well.
We'll talk about moving an issue forward. Oregon and Washington, D.C. are voting on psychedelic mushrooms.
Yeah, psilocybin is could be legalized in a state for the first time this year. I mean, the proponents of the use of psilocybin as a sort of a part of society would just love to see this trend have the success that marijuana does. So they would love to see.
What would the feds think about that?
That will be an issue in Washington, D.C. for sure, whether the funding of it and the enforcement. I would say in Oregon, that's probably going to be less of an issue. You're probably going to see something more like what happened with marijuana. Just there's not going to be any enforcement at the federal level for the most part. And part of the reason is the Oregon measure is, from the perspective of advocates, very conservative. You have to go to a center and actually be under observation for your entire session. You're not going to be able to just grow mushrooms and consume them in your backyard.
I see. Well, that's going to be an interesting one to watch there. And what are you watching for in California, which, of course, every election seems to be stacked with important ballot propositions?
Yeah, California, a huge amount of money being spent as well in California. The top of the list is Proposition 22, which is the first appearance of gig economy policies on the statewide ballot. That measure is backed by Uber, Lyft, DoorDash, Postmates, that group of app-based driver companies. And it's essentially a best defense is a good offense situation. The legislature passed a bill in 2019, AB5, that would reclassify app-based drivers as employees rather than independent contractors. And that business model really sort of depends on the independent contractor style of relationship without the minimum wage requirements or the health insurance requirements and stuff like that. So this measure would reclassify all app-based drivers as independent contractors. It would also add some things like a wage floor and some other sort of employee or independent contractor safety measures as well. So that's what this does. And Uber, Lyft, DoorDash, they're not just thinking about California, even though California is probably huge for them. They're thinking about the entire country. This is a policy area that is new. And so a lot of states are going to be considering it. And whether it passes in November is going to indicate a lot about what direction this policy area will go sort of going forward. It's kind of a referendum on Uber, you might say.
Sure. And, you know, if you live in a state with a key proposition on the ballot, you're likely going to get a bunch of ads bombarding you, urging you to support it or to vote against it. Talk about that for a minute. Who are the groups or the people putting money into these campaigns?
Sure. Yeah. So it varies widely from state to state and by topic. So a lot of times you will have companies on one side or the other of a ballot measure. You could look at Alaska Measure 1, which it's an oil and gas tax, essentially. That's being opposed by exactly who you would expect it to be opposed by, the oil and gas companies. And then you have national advocates, different groups on various sides of measures as well. So whenever you have sort of a national movement behind a measure in a specific state, there's a lot more money involved, whether it's taxes for education or something like that. You have these sort of national groups paying money. And then individuals get involved. In Illinois, the second most expensive measure of the year is a measure that would allow a graduated income tax rather than Illinois' flat income tax rate. And Governor Pritzker is almost single-handedly funding the support campaign, almost $55 million, I think, at this point. And then on the other
He's
side—
He's a very rich man, by the way.
yeah. And then on the other side, you have the CEO of Citadel, who is funding the opposition almost single-handedly. I think 96% of funds on both sides are coming from each of those individuals. So it really does vary from individuals who get passionate about a topic to companies that have a vested interest in the policy to organizations that just exist to advocate for that policy.
Josh Altick at Ballotpedia, thanks so much for taking a look at these with us. And we're going to have you on after the election to see how some of these races turned out.
Sounds good. Thank you so much.
And let's take a minute to breathe, because in the midst of everything that's happening, it's finally autumn, and scientists estimate 4 billion birds all over the U.S. are migrating south. To track when and where they migrate, researchers band some of these birds to identify them later. And that brings us to the discovery of a rare bird at a research station in Appalachia. Kara Holsapple of the Allegheny Front reports.
A bird that is male on one side and female on the other. I'm not describing a creature from mythology, but a rose-breasted grosbeak that was captured recently at Powder Mill Nature Reserve's bird banding station in western Pennsylvania. The name for this phenomenon?
Bilateral gonandromorph. Both sides of the body have its own genome and then also its own sex.
Bird banding program manager Annie Lindsay says the grosbeak is female on its left side and male on its right. You can tell mostly by the way this bird looks.
Female grosbeaks are kind of brown. They have a thick white line above their eyes. And their wing pits, so the under wing coverts, are yellow.
On the male side, the wing feathers are black and white. And under the wing, it's pink.
It's really uncommon, but it is normal.
Lindsay says gonandromorphs occur when an egg doesn't shed an extra cell called a polar body.
Both the polar body and the egg's nucleus are fertilized. That's how this happens.
The grosbeak might be able to reproduce, because in songbirds, the functional ovary is on the left side, where this bird is female. But there's no way to know. Powder Mill researchers took some feather samples from both sides of the bird for genetic analysis. And the grosbeak was banded and measured, treated like any bird at the banding station during fall migration. Almost.
We took a quick video for TikTok, and then we let it go.
In the bird banding program's nearly 65-year history there, they've caught fewer than 10 bilateral gonandromorphs. Lindsay says the best part of the find for her was watching the reaction of the Powder Mill team as they all realized what they had.
You know, the science is important, but that awe and wonder is important as well.
For Here and Now, I'm Kara Holsapple.
A grand juror is speaking out in the case of the shooting death of Breonna Taylor after a judge made the rare decision yesterday that cleared the way for jurors to speak publicly. And one of the officers who shot Taylor in her apartment spoke yesterday for the first time with ABC News and the Louisville Courier-Journal. Jonathan Mattingly said that Breonna Taylor's death was not about race, as people have said about other cases.
This is not relatable to a George Floyd. This is nothing like it. It's not an Ahmaud Arbery. It's nothing like it. It's not a race thing like people want to try to make it to be. It's not. This is a point where we're doing our job, we return fire. This is not us going hunting somebody down. This is not kneeling on a neck. This is nothing like that.
He also said Breonna didn't deserve to die. Tessa Duval, one of the reporters with the Louisville Courier-Journal, spoke with Officer Mattingly. Tessa, what sense did you get overall from him?
I think, you know, he has watched this unfold for the last 7 months and hasn't been able to say anything. So he was very eager to talk, very ready to tell his side of the story and to defend his actions. As we heard him say, you know, he does not consider this to be anywhere in the same ballpark as what happened to George Floyd. He said that is police misconduct, that is overuse of power, but he defended what happened at Breonna Taylor's apartment.
Yeah. Well, just to remind people, Mattingly is one of three officers who came to Breonna Taylor's apartment. They were attempting to serve a search warrant. We heard initially they had a no-knock warrant. They said they knocked on the door. That awoke Kenneth Walker, who was Breonna Taylor's boyfriend, who fired at what he thought were intruders, and the police returned fire. Walker later said he didn't know the police were at the door, and none of the officers were charged for shooting at Breonna Taylor. One was charged for shots that went through a neighboring apartment. So a lot of anger that there were no charges. Did Mattingly say anything about, you know, maybe being upset at why they were there in the first place? Because many have said it just seemed like a ridiculous use of this kind of a forced entry for looking for something that might have been maybe mail from Breonna Taylor's old boyfriend that might have been at the apartment. Did he say anything about that?
Not a lot, but he did defend the use of the warrant. He said, you know, it was requested and approved as a no-knock, but we knocked. We wanted to give her time to come to the door. He also said that, you know, if they had gone in and done a straight no-knock or only waited 5-10 seconds, that he thinks things would have gone differently.
Wait, I just have to jump in. So it was a no-knock warrant, but he knocked. How differently would they have gone, does he say, if he hadn't knocked? Because that's what people are saying. If he hadn't woken up the boyfriend, they might not have frightened him and he might not have shot. So how does he think it would have gone differently if he didn't knock?
If they had not waited as long as they did, he estimates they waited probably 45 seconds to a minute before they used a battering ram to enter, or if they had just, use the ram immediately without knocking, it wouldn't have given them time to get up, and it wouldn't have given Kenny Walker time to grab his gun. And therefore, he said, you know, that first shot may not have been fired, and this whole thing wouldn't have transpired the way that it did.
Yeah. He also told you there's a lot of misinformation out there, such as that they were at the wrong apartment. That's stirred some of this public anger. I want to ask you about this juror who spoke. This is very rare that grand jury members are allowed to speak. Tell us more about what they had to say.
So that's been brewing for a couple of weeks. The grand jury indictment came down on September 23rd. And since then, Daniel Cameron, the attorney general of Kentucky, who was the special prosecutor in this case, has spoken several times about what the grand jurors were told and what the grand jurors decided. And initially, he said that grand jurors agreed with his office's assessment that homicide charges were not warranted because Sergeant Jonathan Mattingly and Detective Miles Cosgrove acted in self-defense after being fired upon. He later, after this grand juror filed the motion, he later said that, well, wanton endangerment against Brett Hankison were actually the only charges presented. We did not present any homicide charges. And so what the grand juror, now that the judge has approved that they can speak publicly, what the grand juror said is, we didn't get to decide on homicide charges. There was no assessment that his office shared that we agreed with because it wasn't even on the table for us. So it's confirming what he later said but did not initially make clear about what happened in the grand jury room.
Just very, very briefly, Tessa, how are people reacting to all this?
I think there's a sense from some people in the community that because the settlement has happened, because the grand jury has already decided on its indictment and, you know, the state criminal case is closed, that this is over. But I think there's also a lot of people here who recognize that this is far from over, that there's still more that we're learning about the case and what happened. Mm-hmm. And they feel like it's still unfinished.
Yeah. Tessa Duval, investigative reporter for the Louisville Courier-Journal. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And we'll follow this story. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.